It's time for Horror Talk, brought to you by The Horror File, digital magazine for all things scary. For more information about Horror Talk, you can email us at talk@horrortalknetwork.com. Horror Talk brings you interviews, insight, reviews, and news related to the horror and pop culture communities. It's Horror Talk on CNY Talk Radio and blogtalkradio.com. Here's your host, J.B. Johnson and Ron Bond.
Welcome to Horror Talk. I'm J.V. Johnson, your host, along with Ron Bonk. Another great program as we quickly approach Scarecon opening weekend.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we are, what, 2 weeks away from the horror convention?
Yeah, I think it's about that, right?
Just racing by.
Yeah.
This is the fifth one. Can you believe it's been five?
Feel like it's all bunched up here. As we get to the end, we have tons of time.
And it's funny because people talk about, you know, oh, remember when that guest was here or this guest was here or when did you have that guest? I can't distinguish one year from the next anymore.
Yeah, I don't remember which years we had who, you know, but they've kind of all blended, but they've always been fun, that's for sure.
Yeah, definitely. And this year is September 11, 12, 13. Of course, if you want information, check it out at scarecon.com. Good program lined up for you. You've got Harrison Smith, who is a writer, director, producer in the horror film community. We're going to talk a little bit with him about trends he sees in the horror film genre, and also some of the projects he's working on, and he's going to be coming to Scarecon to participate in some of our panel discussions, so we'll have a chance to chat with him. Also, later in the program, in our Underground Independent Filmmaker segment, we've got Thomas Edward Seymour. You're familiar with his work, Ron. Director, writer, actor of underground films.
Including, I've known him for a number of years now.
Yeah, yep. Including films like Bikini Bloodbath and its sequels.
Yep.
And Mark.
He did pretty well with those, apparently.
So. Did he? Anything with bikini in the title, you're going to do pretty well. I think you automatically have a sales number you're going to sell without any problem.
Yep.
He also did Mark of the Beast, so we'll chat with Thomas later in the program. And also, of course, classic recommendations from both Ron and I, something you need to put on your must-watch list. Those lists are getting quite long if you haven't been keeping up with us.
Sure have.
And again, I've forgotten, as we were talking about last week. I can't remember which ones.
You compile that list, yeah.
No, I've got to go back and do that, put it on the website, make sure it's all there. Mm-hmm. By the way, if you'd like to email us your list, you should do that. It's talk@horrortalknetwork.com. Let's see what's coming out in theaters. We talked last week about the September 11th premiere or debut or whatever you want to call it of The Visit,
mm-hmm.
M. Night Shyamalan's latest. It's a horror comedy. Eh.
Yeah.
We'll see, right? September 25th, Eli Roth's The Green Inferno coming out. Heard a lot of rumors about this film. Have you?
What sort of rumors? I mean, it was delayed like a year.
Yeah, that's the thing. And it seemed, and also I keep hearing things that this is going to be one of the grossest movies ever.
Oh, possibly. I mean, I've heard it's a remake of Cannibal Holocaust, I've heard people say that, but I've never seen it promoted as such. I mean, it looks like, obviously, it's at least a homage to that movie.
So. Yeah, well, the synopsis is a group of student activists travel to the Amazon to save the rainforest and soon discover that they're not alone and that no good deed goes unpunished.
That's not quite Cannibal Holocaust, but similar.
Well, the Amazon part, right?
And I figured it was Cannibal. It was the jungle somewhere. But yeah, they met unfriendly natives, you know, in that movie as well. So
right.
Of course, they weren't very nice in Cannibal Holocaust. They were kind of a sleazy bunch.
Right. Yeah. Another film opening on the same day, September 25th, is Before I Wake. This one caught my attention because it's Mike Flanagan, who directed Oculus.
Okay.
A couple years ago, also Absentia. The synopsis for this film, a young couple adopt an orphan child whose dreams and nightmares manifest physically as he sleeps.
Hmm. Yeah, I've seen the title. I forget who stars in it. I think it's got a decent name actor or actress in it, but another movie I don't know too much about. I've heard a lot about Green Inferno. There was a lot of excitement last year.
Speaking of Green Inferno, go back to that one. Are you an Eli Roth fan? I mean, people either love him or hate him.
I wasn't a big fan of Cabin Fever. And I'd like to rewatch it because I think I was expecting something different. I didn't like how some of the characters reacted in the movie. But yeah, I mean, I enjoyed Hostel. You know, definitely a fan.
Right. Of course, September 11th is also the Scarecon premiere of Smothered, John Schneider's horror comedy. That's going to be exciting. And if you're a Scarecon attendee, you'll be able to attend that premiere. And we'll hear John introduce the film and then also hold a Q&A afterwards. So that'll be kind of cool.
Yeah, definitely.
What else we got? We've been mentioning Scarecon the whole segment, but some of the celebrities that'll be there, Barry Bostwick, Bill Moseley, Doug Bradley, and of course the whole list is at Scarecon.com. Mm-hmm. And a reminder, listen to the program on CNY Talk Radio, or you can hear us on blogtalkradio.com. All of our past back episodes are there for listening. And, you know, I have to just shout out thanks to all those who've been downloading those podcasts and listening. Those numbers are tallying up nicely, and we like to see that. I mean, hopefully people are enjoying the show. That's the whole point, right?
Yeah, I don't think I can see the numbers there, so I'm not sure how well we've been doing, but you say it's pretty good, huh?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty good. And you can see, it's interesting to see, depending on who our celebrity guest or who our guests are on the program, you can see interesting spikes in the listenership. But we appreciate you doing that. If you do happen to go to blogtalkradio.com and listen to us,
share it.
Well, share it, of course, and also follow us. There's a way to follow us so that every time we have a new program up, it shows up. You know, you get a notification so you can listen to it automatically. And if you go to iTunes and do it, you can actually subscribe to us, and it'll automatically download to your smartphone, you know, in the background when it's time. So,
not up to date on that stuff.
Yeah, I'm just learning it myself. It's a neat little world once you start dipping your toes into it.
Periscope 1 week, but you got off of that.
Oh, you know, we could do. We have a little helper in the studio tonight. We could him do a Periscope for us. You want to do some Periscope for us?
Gladly.
James is joining us in the studio. He's one of the hosts of Ghost Goons, also on the Horror Talk Network, part of our group. He and his co-host Adam talk about films they've been watching and do it from a bit of a younger teen-ish, early 20-something slant, and as opposed to us older guys.
Nice. That's the big money.
And they've been getting some listenings, too.
Yeah. Cool.
Listeners,
cool.
Listenings, whatever.
So I take it's mostly about ghost movies?
Everything.
Oh, okay.
It's anything scary, pretty much. And actually, not scary. You did The Room. You talked about The Room and had some fun chatting with that. Called it a porno that was you never should watch with your mother or your sister. Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Anyway, that's enough for this segment. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll get Harrison Smith on the phone with us. We'll chat a little bit about filmmaking. It's coming up on Horror Talk right here on the Horror Talk Network, brought to you by the Horror File Digital Magazine. Welcome back to Horror Talk. JV here along with Ron Bonk. As I said, we've got a great program lined up for you. If you're listening on CNY Talk Radio, make sure you tell your friends we are on every Saturday. And if you want to go back and listen to some older programs, be sure to check it out online, blogtalkradio.com. Look for the Horror Talk Network. We are the Horror Talk Radio program. There's also Ghost Goons on that network and Taps Paramagazine Paranormal Radio, all on the Horror Talk Network as we continue to expand.
Nice.
Right now, we're going to go to the phones, bring our first guest onto the program with us, and we're talking to Harrison Smith. Harrison is a director, writer, producer, and probably more. Really, he's got his hands in just about every angle when it comes to filmmaking. Welcome to the program, Harrison.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Now, you... you've done it all. You've been involved in some pretty cool projects. But before we talk about the project specifically, I want to. What's your overall take on what's going on? What's the trend in horror films these days? You seeing anything?
I don't know if there's really so much of a trend as I see a lot of recycling is what I see. And I mean, you look at a lot of these horror films now that are coming out, and they all have the kids with the blacked out eyes and. They skip frames as they move real quick, and they're not there, then they're there, that kind of thing. I don't know if there's really a trend. You see a lot of mishmash of, you know, whether it's supernatural, and then, you know, there's sometimes a little torture porn.
Right.
But overall, I guess what I am seeing is a disturbing trend in the remake trend. That's probably my concern, and that it's really not anything that's necessary. I really don't think we needed a remake of Poltergeist.
Yeah. Did you see the remake by any chance?
I did. I always, you know, sit down and I'll try to look at these things and I paid a matinee price to go and sit and watch it, and I think about 15 minutes in, I just wanted to walk out. And it's not because, here's the thing, it's not because the film was really all that terrible.
Mm-hmm.
It's the fact that there was no need to call it Poltergeist.
Right.
If you're just going to, just make a ghost movie.
Right.
You know what I mean? And if you're going to remake movies, remake the bad ones.
Yeah.
You know, why are they remaking the good ones?
That's a great point.
You know what? They've yet to do a good Amityville horror film. And I don't care what anybody says. The original 1979 film is a terrible motion picture. It is bad. It is sloppily put together. It is badly acted. It is overacted by Rod Steiger in a completely embarrassing performance. And it's not scary. You know, when you have a movie about ghosts in a house and you have to revert to a puking nun and grisly shots of a poor family being shot in their sleep, where are the ghosts? And why does the house always have to, like, blow up and explode and all that stuff at the end and some guy's chasing the kids with an axe? Give me ghosts, man.
Right.
And, like,
and talking about the Amityville horror franchise, that movie was bad, and it just got worse from there. The rest of the films that came out after that just didn't
cut it. Ironically, my favorite one out of all of them is the third one that was in 3D with Tony Roberts and Candy Clark, because it's just such a cheese fest that I just absolutely love it.
Right.
I mean, you got monsters coming out of wells and, you know, and really cheesy 3D effects. But at least it kind of knew. You know, the other ones, like, you hear all these fans go, oh, the Amityville Horror was awesome. No, it wasn't. it wasn't, okay? You just are told that it was.
Right.
But it really wasn't.
They did try to remake that one, at least, so.
Yeah, they remade it in, I think, 2004, 2005, and it was just as abysmal. It, you know, and in the end, Ryan Reynolds is chasing everybody with a freaking axe. Give me the ghost.
Well, I mean, we've seen on the horizon news about a Nightmare on Elm Street remake or reboot.
Yeah,
I mean, and you're absolutely right. I suppose that if you're the money men behind some of these projects, you say, we don't want to make a bad one because it was bad. We want to ride the coattails of a good one because it was good. So it's more bankable. Does that seem to be the case?
Well, I think, yeah. I mean, you're kind of double dipping on it. You're trying to lure back the original viewers who saw this stuff in the 80s.
Right.
And so, you know, and then they're going to bring their kids, you know, that kind of thing. But the problem is, like, the Nightmare on Elm Street remake, the first one with Jackie Earle Haley, I mean, that was, the problem was, it was almost a shot-for-shot remake. What did they try to do? They tried to do an M. Night Shyamalan twist that, was he a child molester? Wasn't he? You know, that kind of thing. In the end, it was just one of those that you walk out going, okay, you have Rooney Mara, and everything was good on that, and he had some good acting, and it was beautifully produced. Jackie was great, but the issue really comes down to is, was this trip really necessary? Did we need this?
Right.
What's wrong with the 1984 version? And I'm tired of hearing everybody go, well, it's old, it has to be updated for a modern audience. What modern audience? The kids that they're gearing this toward, they don't go to the movies, dude. They rip movies. They pirate them.
Right. I'm waiting for the remake of Porky's. That's when that happens, then we could talk.
Stern was going to do that for a while.
I mean, not that Porky's was any classic, but it was what it was for the 80s.
Right.
And there's no need to be remake. I'm glad that, for some reason, I'm really glad they pulled the plug on the Revenge of the Nerds remake. I heard that the college that was hosting it or something, you know, read the script and found it so raunchy and terrible that they pulled the plug on it, which is probably they did us a favor.
Yeah, and did I hear that there was actually talk of a Breakfast Club remake?
Ooh.
Yeah, there's a talk. I mean, that's what I mean. Oh. Why are we doing this?
It's crazy.
Go back and remake Jaws 3. Jaws 3 is terrible.
Right.
Go remake it.
There's got to be some great bombs, like Remake the Room or something like that. But do it right.
The,
and then
would
it be fun?
Right.
I don't know.
Go back and make the remake the crappy ones.
Right,
but
right.
Enough with the good one.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, they don't need to be updated. That is lazy.
Yeah.
That's laziness. That's by an audience that goes, well, it needs to be updated. For what? Does the original 1933 King Kong need to be re-updated? Does it?
No, but they have.
No. I mean, a good story is a good story.
Right.
Do we have to update the Mona Lisa?
No. Leave it alone.
Well, we go unfortunately, to the museum and you see, you know, you see an ancient Greek statue. Do we have to update that for a modern audience?
Right. No, that's a good point. We really struck a nerve here with Harrison. Right out of the blocks.
I know, because then everybody thinks they sound like I'm ranting. The problem that I have is I'm actually passionate about something. And the other problem that is that the people listening go, oh, he's ranting or all. No, you're just not passionate enough. You're asleep.
Right.
That's the problem. You're being fed this garbage, and you think it's perfectly okay. Like, if it wasn't for the fact that people are shooting each other in movie theaters now, I wanted to stand up in Jurassic World and look at everybody and go, don't you people realize it's the same damn movie? We're being rooked here. We're being screwed. And I was afraid somebody would think I'm crazy, you know?
Yeah. Well, getting back to trends a little bit, I've noticed a real increase in the number of horror comedies entering the market. Is that something you've seen as well, or am I just crazy?
Yeah, you know, the funny part is from a distribution end of things, horror comedy is a hard sell, man. You better have some really good names attached, because the problem with horror comedy is that it doesn't really translate well overseas. That's the issue.
Right.
So, you know, if it's a horror movie, that's one thing because, you know, the images are scary and the atmosphere, and you don't need a lot of dialogue. But with a horror comedy, it's got to be, and, you know, it's tough. I mean, like, you know, I still don't understand the whole cult following of Tucker and Dale versus Evil. I get it, but I don't really understand why this thing became a phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it wasn't really all that funny. And I, you know, it was a lot of CGI blood and stuff. And I mean, it's not a bad movie, but I just don't understand. I mean, is it because there's so much mediocre product that when something comes out that's just a click above average, we go nuts for it?
Right. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Now, the trend in horror comedy is a hard one to comment on, because from somebody who has several, what I think are probably pretty good horror comedies, and not just that I wrote, but other projects, man, you walk into distributors and they're like, we don't know.
Yeah.
You know?
Did you see Hellbaby?
Did I see what?
Hellbaby.
No, not yet, no.
I thought that was done really well. But you mentioned to me at one point, Harrison, that you know, you had some thoughts on the zombie trend.
Yeah.
And that we've kind of peaked that crest and it's kind of done.
Well, I think it's done for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Everything comes back. Mm-hmm. You know, look, vampires. I mean, Fright Night in 85 brought back the vampire craze. You know, if it wasn't for Fright Night 1985, you wouldn't have had Twilight, which I don't know whether to thank Fright Night or kick it in the ass for that one. You know, but, you know, you wouldn't have had Buffy the Vampire Slayer. You wouldn't have had this resurrection, pardon the pun, of vampires.
Mm-hmm.
The zombie thing, yeah, I mean, you know, aside from putting them in space, what are you going to do with them?
Zombies in space.
True.
Right. When, trust me, I'm sure that's coming.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, what more can you do with them?
Well, I
mean, The Walking Dead, okay, we have The Walking Dead. Now we have Fear the Walking Dead. Well, gee, what's going to happen on there?
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, each episode of The Walking Dead, despite how well-produced, it is a wonderful show. It is extremely well-done, well-acted, mm-hmm. produced, written, everything. But every episode is the same, and that is people argue and zombies attack.
Right.
That's what it is.
Yep. Yeah.
And that's okay if that's what you want.
Right. And I think that we saw a tipping of the scales here, because the Fear of the Walking Dead, despite the fact I think it had the highest debut of any cable program or something like that,
right.
The reviews have not been good.
No, the reviews have been tepid at the best.
Yeah.
You're not, and the reason why is, what did it bring new to the table?
Exactly.
Okay, so now we're going back to the beginning of the zombie outbreak.
Right.
And we can't go too far away from The Walking Dead, so even the opening resembles the opening of the original Walking Dead, because we don't want to upset our fan base, because people can't think anymore, so we better just spoon-feed them basically the same damn thing all over again, except it's now in Los Angeles instead of Atlanta, Georgia.
Right. And I think one of the problems The Walking Dead faces now, in its, what, we in heading into sixth season?
I think so.
Is that the first couple of seasons, one of the things that made it such a unique program is that every character was fair game, you know, as far as being killed off. And I think they've gotten to the point now where they're so reliant on some of those key characters for ratings that they don't dare kill them off.
Yeah,
right.
But I think the minor characters, well, not the minor, but the less key characters are still a risk. I mean, I still feel like...
Yeah, but who are the less key characters anymore? I mean, there aren't
any. The only
any.
Two key characters,
they don't last long enough to become, like, they don't even last long enough to be kind. They're almost extras anymore. They're not even minor characters.
Yeah, but I think you could have Maggie die in any episode. You could have what's her boyfriend's name?
Glenn.
You could have Glenn die.
I thought Glenn
was going to go last season.
Really?
Actually,
okay.
Yeah.
So. All right.
So I was surprised he made it. So to me, they're still. I only figure it's Rick and what's his face?
Norman Reedus.
Yeah.
And Chandler
Riggs. Yeah, the only guarantees that not to die, yeah. But the other ones I think are fair game. So.
Yeah, interesting. Okay. Well, let's move on. Harrison, you've had some pretty high-profile projects recently. I've heard you talking about them before, but I'd love to hear you talk about them a little bit more. Specifically, you know, Camp Dread, Zombie Killers. You start where you want to start, but Camp Dread,
sure.
Eric Roberts, Daniel Harris, Felissa Rose. Tell us about that project.
Sure. Camp Dread was my directing debut. We did a bit of a tip of the hat, well, more than a tip of the hat to the 80s slasher genre. And, you know, my investor had come to me and said, listen, I just want a lot of boobs and blood, and that's what I want. And I said, well, could we make something good, too? Like, you know, I mean, it's easy to do that. That's not hard. And we came up with a really cool idea on the summer camp slasher with one hell of a twist ending to it. And it also reflects a kind of cynical updating to when you finally get the reveal at the end of what's going on. And so it's pretty cool. We brought back Felissa Rose. The reason why is I wanted her for the part of Rachel in the film because of her sleepaway camp.
Sure.
Role.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's so great to bring her back. And she is not Angela Baker. It is not a sequel to Sleepaway Camp. But it is, you know, a nice nod to that franchise, and it was a real coup to get her in. In fact, Felissa credits the film with kind of, you know, other than Sleepaway Camp, really resurrecting interest in her. She's very proud of the film, and she loves it. And Eric Roberts feels the same way. Eric was a wonderful villain, and I remember on set, I asked him, I said, what made you take the role? And he said, well, I came down for breakfast one morning, and my wife had this script sitting on the table, and she said, you're going to do that movie.
Eliza.
Saw the title, which was originally Dead TV, and he said, why am I going to do this? She goes, because it has one hell of an ending, and it's really good.
Very cool.
So that's how we got him.
Now, you're going to have to remind me, when I see you at Scarecon, you're going to have to remind me that I got to go tell Felissa how much indebted she is to you for revitalizing her career. You're going to have
to... it's not that she's indebted to me.
It was just
that, you know, she had said that, you know, look, you know, Angela Baker is what everybody knows me for,
right.
And now she goes to cons and people are like, oh my God, I loved you in Camp Dread. And she said everywhere, you know, every con that she goes to, you know, people are asked about Camp Dread and Zombie Killers, and that's just really nice, you know, because I wrote the role for her and I never knew her.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, it was a reporter on the set of 6 Degrees of Hell when we were making that. And he said, what do you got coming up next? It was for Fangoria.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I got this, you know, summer camp slasher movie. And I said, but I'll only do it if I can get Felissa Rose to be in it. And he said, oh, I know Felissa Rose. And I said, oh, okay. He goes, do you want her phone number? I'm like, no, but you could do, a nice email introduction so I don't come across as a psychotic, you know, stalker.
Right. So in Camp Dread, Eric Roberts, who has to be like the most prolific actor visiting sets these days, because he seems to be in everything.
Yeah.
He was a guest at Scarecon last year, in fact. But y'all, Danielle Harris, and what a... She's really come of age.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Danielle was awesome. And, you know, the best part about working with Danielle, and she's remained now a good friend, is, you know, she's such a great filmmaker as well, too. She's well aware of her origins. You know, she was doing stuff before she was, you know, Jamie Lloyd.
Right.
And you know what I mean? And her take on things, like, it was great just sitting on set and discussing film with her and discussing other projects with her. And most of all, she's just such a pro. I mean, when that girl is on set, she is in the zone. I mean, there's no getting past her, you know, like,
right.
She is that character.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of the actors, you know, sat and talked with her and they learned from her. And most of all, she's just an extremely pleasant and very sweet and nice person.
Yeah. And then Zombie Killers, that's fairly recent. Misha Barton, Billy Zane, Dee Wallace, and again, Felissa Rose. That's some great
incredible
talent
kiss.
There. Yeah.
Yeah, we did great with that one. Dee Wallace is, I mean, she's E.T.'s mom. She's
right.
America's mom, really.
Right.
And, Getting her was just somebody. I mean, I've always wanted to work with Dee Wallace. I mean, I still say to this day she was robbed of an Oscar for Cujo. Mm-hmm. She should have at least had a nomination for Cujo.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that woman, she did, you know, combat pay on that one. So, and then in addition, you know, working with Billy Zane, I mean, you know, just the legend that he is.
Yeah.
And Titanic and everything. Yeah. And again, finding out that, you know, Billy Zane himself also is a filmmaker and to discuss real cinema with him on set. And most of all, Billy just had such a great twisted sense of humor. And we just loved working with him. He was such a pleasure to work with. And then Misha Barton, you know, from The O.C. and The Sixth Sense. And
right.
He was just bringing all these people together. It was just a good time. And again, with the zombie thing, we were looking to kind of try to change some things up. And we knew it's like making a shark movie. You're going to get invariably, you know, compared to Jaws. Well, of course, everybody's going to say, oh, it's a Walking Dead ripoff. No, it's not. It's more of an American Western than it is anything else. Mm. It's not a Walking Dead ripoff. We did not have anything to do with that. And most of all, we fine-tuned it more toward a, I don't want to say a family audience, but a wider demographic, because we didn't want the explicit heads blowing up and all of that stuff. We wanted to try something up and do something different.
Cool. Now, you've spent more of your time recently producing, right, than directing, and I know you're always writing. So how do you like that role? How do you like being a producer?
I like it. It's kind of like putting on a wedding and a concert at the same time. So, you know, it's hard to do all of that, and especially when you're producing, directing, and writing. You rarely, when you're producing and you're doing all three, do you have the chance to really become creative. You know, you're constantly worrying about, you know, making sure that SAG is taken care of and
right.
People are paid yeah. on time and checks roll out and receipts are kept and the line producer's doing their job and making sure also all your departments are on budget. I mean, you know, at the end of the night as a director, you're supposed to sit down and look at dailies and go over creative decisions. I never have yet to get a chance to do that.
Yeah.
It's always, okay, fill me in on what we had to spend today. Let's do this. What broke down? What needs to be replaced? What's been repaired? It's all that stuff all the time.
Yeah. You are coming to ScaraCon. You're going to participate in some of our filmmaking networking and panels, you know, talking a little bit about the inside filmmaking business. Give us a sample of the types of things that you think are important to people breaking into the business these days.
Well, the big thing is having perspective, and that is the minute, you know, somebody comes up to me and says, oh, I've got the next Star Wars, my answer is, no, you don't. No, you don't. You know, and that's the job of your parents and your elementary teachers to tell you you're special and wonderful.
Right.
No, you don't.
Yeah.
And so, like, even today, like, you know, in the news, Max Landis, you know, the son of John Landis,
uh-huh.
is, you know, kind of being a crybaby in the news about that American Ultra failed. And, you know, he's like, well, it was a good script. I don't know why it failed. And he's blaming endless sequels and remakes. And it's like, yes, there is maybe some substance to what you're saying. But did you ever stop to think that maybe your script wasn't as precious as you thought and were told it was?
Right.
You know, because this is the new generation, this new millennial generation that is getting into film. My advice to them is to understand that you are not special. Okay, you are not going to be the next Spielberg. Yes, there are Spielbergs that are up and coming, but what makes you think you're the one?
Right.
And that doesn't mean to say, no, don't go in and do your best and all that. Simply love movies and go out and make them. Stop talking about it. So that's my first advice.
Mm-hmm.
Don't talk about making a movie. Do it. You know?
Right.
And that means if you have $500 in the bank, you figure out a way, man. And you go and you do it. You don't sit around and talk about what a genius you are and what a great story you had. And if you only had the money, you do it. No, you'll find a way
right.
to do it. And that's the first advice that I give. This industry has enough talkers. And anybody who's really experienced it and been in the trenches will tell you that. You know, you go to California and L.A. and everybody's got a project. Everybody knows someone.
Mm-hmm.
Like I had one guy tell me, give me your script. I'm going to a wedding this weekend. I know Jennifer Aniston. I'm going to give it to her. Well, right there, I know you're an amateur. Because if you really knew Jennifer Aniston, pick up your phone right now and call
right.
her.
Right.
But see, you can't do that because you don't know her. And second of all, if I'm Jennifer Aniston and I'm at a wedding, the last thing I want is somebody handing me a script.
Exactly. Right.
she's going to take it, even if he does put it in her hand,
and throw it.
She's going to promptly throw it out.
Throw it out, exactly.
Because just what that woman wants to do is walk around a wedding with a script under her arm.
Right.
From some putz who claims that he knows her.
Right.
No, you don't. If you know Jennifer Aniston, call her right now in front of me.
Yep.
Call her.
Yep, yep.
Oh, you can't do that? Well, then you don't know her.
Right.
See, I can call Billy Zane right now. I can call Misha Barton. I can call Dee Wallace. I can call Adrienne Barbeau. I can do all of those things because I know these people and I work with them.
And there's a level of respect you've earned.
And there's, right. And so my first advice to anybody breaking into the business is don't talk. Do.
Yeah.
You know, and don't fall in love with your project. You know, I had a guy come to me, he said, oh, this dentist, he's giving me $50,000. I'm going to make a zombie movie. I'm like, you do not want to make a zombie movie. He's like, yeah, I do. No, you don't. I said, take the 50 grand, find a better project, find other equity investors, build that up to 150, 250, maybe 500,000, and make yourself a decent movie and make something different because everybody's making zombie movies. And the reason why everybody makes them is because they're easy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's why they all make them. They all think they're easy, and that is, I'll just get 50 of my stupid friends, and we'll have them spit goo out of their mouths and walk around and ripped up clothing, and, you know, people argue and zombies will attack.
Right.
And there you go.
Yeah.
Getting people that like good zombies is actually pretty difficult.
Yeah.
You think everyone would be able to do
it
really well?
They think it's easy. They think it's easy.
Yeah, as soon as you put them on video and you realize, oh, my God, this is the worst zombie I've ever seen.
Yeah. You know, I mean, look, there are some really great zombie movies out there. There truly are. But most of them are garbage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the reason why everybody makes them is because they think they're that easy to make.
Right.
And that's why, you know, as soon as I hear it, like even I tried talking my investor out of making a zombie movie. You know, when I was sitting on the set of Camp Dread, we were drinking one night. My DP said to me, he goes, would you ever make a zombie movie? I'm like, hell no, I wouldn't make a zombie movie. And he's like, why? And I said, because they're like NASCAR. They're the NASCAR of horror. And that is, they just go around and around on a track, and people stand there and watch it go around and around. And, you know where it begins, you know where it ends, and you hope for a couple of exciting crashes in between.
Right.
I mean, like, you know, when you see people on Twitter with The Walking Dead, oh, I wonder what's going to happen Sunday night. I don't know. What do you think's going to happen? You know?
Yeah.
What do you think?
Right.
You think some people are going to die? You think they're going to shoot some zombies? Gee, what do you think's going to happen? You know?
We talked about, I think, that last week.
Yeah.
Every Walking Dead always has the zombie.
There's a formula.
Yeah, there's always one scene where they go out and kill a bunch of zombies. Every single week they have to have that.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
You got to give the audience what they want.
You got to feed them the red meat.
So I told this guy, I said, please don't do this. He took the $50,000. He made a terrible zombie film, which I probably could even give you the link after the show just to, I don't want to do it online.
Sure.
On the air and embarrass this poor guy. But it was one of the worst movies ever. And it wasn't even really a movie. And, you know, and the problem is he totally wasted that guy's money. Now, what do you think that investor is going to think the next time if somebody says,
right,
hey, would you like to invest in a movie of mine?
Yep.
And these kind of people ruin it for the people that are really out there trying to get equity investors.
Yep.
You know?
Yep.
Like, even $50,000. Like, this dentist, even if he knew five other guys that were willing to put $100,000 in each, you think he's going to do that now?
Right.
Yeah, a lot of
you know,
it.
He's
going to
be like,
it.
Oh, I gave this guy 50 grand and he ruined it. I told him, I said, you should have taken that 50 grand and set it on fire.
Jeez.
Well, you know?
The problem with a lot of the zombie movies, I think, is the guys who are making zombie movies, they make them about the zombies too much. You know, they're too much into the gore. They don't make them about the characters.
I just saw on Netflix, I think it was. It was an Australian zombie flick in Harrison.
Wormwood.
Was it Wormwood? Where they're in the.
Wormwood.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it was Wormwood. And that was actually done
with
real
Bianca,
well.
Yeah, Bianca Brady, and I know Bianca.
Yeah, yeah, that was good.
She's awesome in it, and that was a nice, fresh take on the zombie thing. I thought it was a little too reliant on CGI blood and gore, but they did a great job with it, and most of all, they had a good script and some quirky characters, and they changed it up a little bit. I mean, it's still zombies,
right?
But it worked.
Right.
Yeah, it had something different going for it.
Yeah.
But you're right.
Absolutely.
It needs like a unique twist, like a Peter Jackson Dead Alive or something, you know, some sort of unique, different twist on the zombie genre. They're all about people trying to survive a zombie apocalypse.
Well, it's like the Jaws movie. And that is the reason why Jaws is so great is because it's not about the shark.
Right.
okay? The when the series started to decline, which was with the second one, it was all about the shark.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that was the problem. When the movie started to become about the shark, we don't care anymore. Then it just becomes a monster movie.
Right.
Jaws is a people movie.
Yep.
Siskel and Ebert, I think.
The real villain in Jaws is the mayor.
Right.
Right. Siskel and Ebert had said with each movie, I remember when they reviewed part three, they said the first one had four interesting characters, you know, including the shark was the fourth. Second one had two, you know, Brody and the shark. And then the third one just had the shark. You know, they got away from the character. And the shark alone wasn't enough to sell, especially in three. I mean, the shark was done horribly in that.
Three was bad enough, but Jaws the Revenge, the fourth one, in my opinion, is the worst motion picture of all time.
I didn't think they could make it worse than three, and they did.
Oh, they did, yeah. They did it in spades.
Yeah. Hey, Harrison, we're out of time, but before we go, I want to give you an opportunity.
Oh, wait, there's a big movie we didn't discuss, is there?
Oh, we got to talk about another one?
Well, you didn't talk about Death House, which I saw is like, got an amazing cast.
Oh, yeah, let's talk about Death House. We got about 90 seconds. What do you got?
Sure. Death House is being produced by Entertainment Factory and Rick Finkelstein and Steve
Oh, yeah, this is one you're working on now, right?
That's right. We're working on it now.
This
looks like
it's
getting up ready for a fall shoot.
Yeah.
We have a great cast. We're locking down some bigger celebrity names, too, or younger ones, I should say. But we have a great horror cast. It's going to be like the Expendables of horror. Like, a lot of names are going to be in this.
Can you give us any of the names now?
I can tell you
some of them, like Bill Moseley, Robert Englund, people like that.
Yeah.
Doug Bradley.
We're really excited about it. Danny Trejo. You know, it's all these names will be popping up, but it will not be a gimmick horror movie. I can promise you that. It won't be one of those like gimmick films where it's like, oh, look, it's so-and-so. We're not doing that.
Okay. Cool. And when's that get underway? When do you expect it to be released?
We're looking, well, I can't say the release date. That'll be up to the distributor, but we're looking at cameras starting to roll in October.
Awesome. Awesome. Great. And before we let you go, if anybody wanted to follow you, see what you're up to, kind of keep an eye on your projects or get involved, you know, if you've got, how would they find you?
You can find me on Twitter at HarrisonSmith85.
Awesome. Hey, thanks for joining us, Harrison. We look forward to seeing you at Scarecon and chatting more about all this stuff there.
Definitely.
Same here. And I really thank you for the time and having me on.
Harrison Smith, great guy. A lot of great projects and great insight. I love his take on the industry. It's pretty cool. I'm anxious to hear what he's got to say on some of the panels.
Yeah, hear someone who's so passionate you know, about the industry like that, because some of these guys, you think they fell asleep at the wheel. So
right. There are a few of those, for sure. Well, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we will be going into our underground filmmaker segment. Ron's going to bring a guest in. It's all coming up here on Horror Talk on CNY Talk Radio and blogtalkradio.com. Welcome back to the program, Horror Talk, on CNY Talk Radio and blogtalkradio.com, brought to you by the Horror File Digital Magazine. Scarecon coming up around the corner. We've got James, one of the ghost goons, in the studio with us, helping us out with a little Periscope action there. We were on
for a while there.
Yeah, we were doing some broadcasting.
I kind of forgot. I started picking my nose.
Were you doing that? I was giving it the finger most of the time. But the funny thing is, on that Periscope thing, which is awesome, but they couldn't hear our guest, who was doing most of the talking, which, you know, because we're listening through headphones. But speaking of guests, we've got our underground indie filmmaker guest ready to go here.
Yeah, we got Thomas Edward Seymour on the line. Thomas, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
He's been making horror movies, action movies, comedy movies for a while now. He's even working on a documentary recently, so we wanted to chat with him a little bit about his career. I first came across Thomas, I think, from Phil Hall, introduced me to you. I think he was promoting your Thrill Kill Jack and Hail Manor movie.
Yeah, I think
Sent him my way, and we showed at the film festival. I think all your stuff is shown at my film festivals over the years, including Land of College Prophets won, like, all the big awards one year. So
huge.
Thrill Kill Jack, that was your first feature you ever made or your first one you ever released?
It technically got released. It bounced, a bunch of distributors over the years. But that was like an 80-minute film. We shot it on high eight, and even parts in VHS, if you can believe that.
Oh yeah.
and essentially, it was this guy breaks into a house in search of his mystical gun, and basically was shot in a series of people's living rooms and kitchens and things like that.
You guys are all really young, I remember, in the video.
Oh, yeah. But we were just trying to see if we could do it, see if we could make, like, an 80-minute movie.
It was definitely quirky and different. I think it gets overlooked. You know, I see every so often, like, a VHS pop up on eBay, and I hope people pick it up and check it out. So then after that, you moved on to a comedy with Everything Moves Alone. What made you go the comedy route, especially at a low budget, you know, in the low budget genre?
That was a matter of, you know, I think we had seen Del Mariachi, and we got really inspired to try to do something. Because the way I feel about Everything Moves Alone, it was sort of a comedic drama, probably more comedy for sure, but... we had, you know, seen films like Bottle Rocket, and we thought that, you know, we could do that sort of genre justice, and we thought it was a good opportunity to try it. So we actually shot that on 16mm film, and that's the only feature film that I did on 16mm film, actually.
Yeah, it's been so long since I've seen it, I didn't remember that you shot it on film. I was going to ask you if you've shot anything on film, so... But, yeah, I remember just being a really funny, well-made movie. Again, played my film festival and may have won some awards that year. I don't remember now.
Yeah, you guys have, you know, you specifically have, Ron, have been really supportive over the years.
Well, I've definitely been a big fan, you know, from the very start. So.
Thomas, yeah, let's get into the meat of this. I want to know about Bikini Bloodbath.
Wait, we're getting to that. I want to talk about...
Am I jumping ahead?
We have to, because Land of College Prophets, the one he made before that, is my favorite of all his movies. And it's just so cool and big and epic on a low-budget, low-scale concept. You know, but just the way you did it, I don't know how to classify the movie. How would you classify Land of College Prophets?
You know, I think backyard comic book adventure, maybe.
Comic book, that'd be good, yeah.
You know, Mike Watt actually wrote this book, and he and the book was based upon films that he called kitchen sink movies, which basically just meant it was the genre Everything. Of under. It's a bunch of, you know, some comedy, some action, some, you know, dash of horror, you know, dash of trauma. and that was a bitch to make. I mean, that was very difficult. I think
it was very epic in many ways.
You know, and then it did pretty well. York Entertainment bought it. I think it was released in maybe like 8 different countries. Most fun things is just looking up online on the variations in the covers. Like there's an Italian version, there's a Russian version, and that was amazing to me at the time. I thought that, I made it. I'm a real filmmaker.
Now we can move on to that Bikini Bloodbath.
I really didn't mean to jump over anything important. I just saw Bikini Bloodbath.
Well, he's obviously been very successful at that series because he's done 3 of them.
Right.
Was that originally planned 3, or did each one sort of come out because the one before had done so well?
Actually, no. Like the truth being told, the idea was to make several of them and keep pushing them out to the public under the illusion that they might think, oh, well, they must be fairly successful if they made a second one. Oh, and then a third one. But they did pretty well. I think the first one was shot for $8,000, and that one had W. Rochon in it.
Yep.
And Maggie Champagne, who is now doing like Amy Schumer shows now.
Nice.
But I think it brought in about maybe 25.
That's good.
25 grand, and then the second one we made for about 12, and that brought in about, 15, and then the third one we made for 12, and I think that brought in, it's probably close to breaking even. So we didn't clean up because, you know, we did promotion and things like that, but they did make a profit, you know. They made a very you know, small but decent prop, especially for underground film, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I was going to ask why you had stopped making them. I mean, it's been, what, 6 years, 7 years since the last one? But yeah. I think you kind of answered that. If the money goes down, then time to focus on a new subject?
I think if we hit Indiegogo, I think we could probably get enough dough to make one. It just really, for now, we feel like it ran its course. Things are difficult to make. It's a lot of money. It was a lot of money, but a lot of time. And, you know, using the same crew, it just, things were a little thin, but I think that it could be done again. If John Gorman, my co-director, really is amped to do another one, I'm sure we'll take a look at it.
Did you get kind of tired of doing sort of the same? I mean, I know the plots were varied a little bit, but it was still kind of the same basic idea.
Very similar plot. As a matter of fact, one of the funniest stories that I have is that, you know, we were getting close to the time in which we needed to start having Bikini Bloodbath Christmas a script ready. And we, believe it or not, we had all the actors in place. We didn't have to finish the script. And John said to me, he's like, I don't think we can do this. We have to get a script done by this weekend, like next weekend. And because they're, you know, the actors are asking for this script. So we actually took the second script and did a few things happened. Devi Rashan was supposed to act in the third one the whole time. Mm-hmm. Something happened with scheduling, so we had to shoot her stuff later. So Bikini Bloodbath 3 has Dick Bolin in drag, partially because that was supposed to be Devi Rashan, and we didn't have time to rewrite the script, so we're just like, you know what, Dick Bolin, you're Devi Rashan's sister, and you're dressed in drag. And that's how that came to be. And with some of the other characters, we actually did word replace with their characters' names. You know what I mean? So it's like, you're not Mercedes anymore. You're you know, Jenny. So it was like kind of funny
same,
like that.
Same script.
Yeah, honestly.
Do you think you did it better the second time?
Yeah. So anyway. But they were fun. But it did feel like, oh, man, to do a fourth one. I mean, there was just other stuff I wanted to do, and each one of these takes a few years to make just because, well, you know how it is, you know.
No, yeah, it takes me like 3 years to turn this stuff out. But in the midst of doing those, you did do London Betty, which was totally different type movie, comedy. I remember it made it onto a Blockbuster shelves. You had some pretty decent named stars, I think, in that one.
Yeah, it turned out to be Daniel Von Bargen's last film, who played Mr. Kruger in Seinfeld, Cassandra's boss in the last season, and Clint Howard narrated it, and Nicole Lewis did a bunch of, who plays Linda Betty, she's a Broadway actress. And
It's funny, and a quick side note on Clint Howard, one day I had been talking to him online, I forget why, I think I was trying to bring him up for B-Fest as a guest. And he's like, oh, Ron Bunk, I heard of you. And I was like, oh, wow, he heard of me. I always thought maybe it was because, you know, heard of my movies or something. I was all excited. I think he heard of me because of your movie. You mentioned him to me.
Awesome.
Yeah, so, but then it was cool, but it wasn't like, hey, I made it, you know, sort of cool. But go ahead, I didn't mean to cut you off on London Betty.
No, I like that. I like to some people name drop, and I like my name dropping is, have you heard of Clint Howard? You know, I love it. So London Betty, that was really something that I just wanted to do it. That was a real dedicated attempt to try to make a comedy adventure that would be not more mainstream, but I think it's slightly less culty than some of the other stuff I've done.
Yeah.
And, you know, we sold it to Maverick Entertainment. You know, they never paid us, just like New York Entertainment never paid us.
You didn't get in advance at that? For some reason, I thought you'd gotten in advance because of the deal you'd gotten. Like, I thought you got like the gold status deal or something where they advance money.
I wish. Oh. I've never gotten that deal. Actually, the distributor we work with now, MVD, which, Ron, do you work with those
guys? Yeah, they handle all my DVD mainstream
I find them the most honest distributor I've ever worked with.
They're great. They're super honest. They send everything out to you that, you know, as far as their expenses and stuff. So I love dealing with them, but the problem is that, you know, DVD just doesn't sell that well. So.
No, I know. It's a real problem. And they are sort of exploring getting into other areas, but I just think, you know, what happened is that the, streaming revenue didn't replace DVDs. It just, you know, it's mostly evaporated.
Yeah, it's not consistent enough, for sure.
Yeah. Well, I mean, of course, I'm preaching to the choir here. You know more about it than I do. I mean, you run one of the longest-running distribution companies in basically in American history, right? I mean, you're running, what, almost 20 years now? Or?
It's been a while. I think I'm only behind Troma as far as indie studios right now.
That's pretty cool.
But no, I always do like to hear about other filmmakers' experiences because as much as I get out there, there's a lot of stuff I don't get out to. So I'm always kind of surprised to hear about other people's experiences or where they've been successful. So... VOD's been tough. We've only been able to cut deals if it's been HD movies, and they just, again, they haven't been consistent enough. They're not like every movie. So if you don't have a name in it, you're not getting on Netflix. And everyone thinks Netflix is the big deal. As far as I know, Netflix only paying about $1,200 for a movie, so it's not really a big deal to get on Netflix.
Yeah.
Hey, Tom. Yeah. I mean, you know, they have, for Netflix, the only thing I have on there was the first two Bikinis physical DVD and then Atlantic College Profits. Mm-hmm. But they were actually going to, they offered a deal MVD for all three Bikinis streaming. And the deal was just, you know, frankly, it was just, I don't really care because I don't think my flicks are going to be on Netflix because they're just too cool for school now. But their deals were shit. I mean,
I was talking to someone about Netflix recently. I forget who it was, and I said, it's almost like you kill your movie by going on Netflix because they don't pay you very much, and then everyone can see it. And
it's Netflix. Done, yeah. It's done. Did I mean, it was under 1,000, I think.
Oh, okay.
It was probably $400 or $500 for three Bikini Bubba films.
Yeah,
you know?
Oh, geez, that's bad, yeah.
It was really, and actually MVD was like, guys, you know, you could just put it on Amazon and Google Play and
make
that back. So we did that, the streaming sales are actually all right. It's not killer, but it's they do bring in a little dough every month, just a little bit.
Yeah. Hey, Thomas, I'd like to bring you back a little bit. Looks like you started really working on this stuff, and I'm sure you were working prior to that. About 2000, though, is when I see the releases starting.
Yeah.
How'd you get your start, and who were some of your influences? Who were you watching up to that point that inspired you?
Up to that point, I guess, honestly, like Toxic Avenger was, Lloyd Kaufman's Toxic Avenger was something I watched very early, and I had to borrow my Super 8, my neighbor's Super 8 camera because I, you know, couldn't afford one, and we shot like this animated, really crude claymation thing called The Nuclear Warrior with my friend Craig, and that was like I must have been like 12.
Oh, cool.
And it kind of started from there. So a lot of my, and also, you know, both of my brothers, my brother Bruce owned Fun Stuff Video, which was a chain in Connecticut, and they would rent movies. My older brother Dan actually worked for this other chain called Applause Video when that was around. Mm-hmm. But they could bring home movies, but they would never bring home the A titles. They would always bring home, like, you know, because Dan was like an employee, and they're like, no, you can't take Pulp Fiction home. You have to take Best of the Best with Eric Roberts home. You know, so my influence were like not the best quality films. So, you know, like Blind Fury with Rutger Hauer, or like, I'm just trying to think of like these really sort of, you know, mediocre direct-to-video films, which Dead Heat with Joe Piscopo, stuff like
those
that.
Those are the funnest,
like,
movies, though.
yeah. You know, so these are, you know, those are not my favorite films now, of course, but, I mean, if I'm going to be honest, what I was brought up on was a lot of direct-to-video, actually, you know. But I guess I went to, my grades were crap in high school, and after I actually started a public access show called Pungent Fun right out of high school, and then I went to Northwestern Connecticut Community Technical College, and I studied in their little film program there, and that was enough to eventually get a, they called it vacation relief, but there was a CBS News affiliate, and they needed someone to come in. They gave me a beeper, and they basically said, if you get beeped, you have to come in to work. So I'd drive in the middle of Hartford at like 3 in the morning to edit, and just no one wanted that. Like, that was the only reason I got in, because no one in their right mind wanted to do that. So I did that, and then eventually got hired full-time there. I did that for 4 years, but the whole time I was sort of making these little independent films, you know, usually self-financing or getting my family to chip in, stuff like that.
Has that led to the documentary you're making now, which I see two listings for, maybe you can explain why, for the VHS Massacre?
Oh, yeah. You know, that was like, I entered one listing had been up for a while, and then I started doing Without a Box to Enter Festivals, it generated a second title. I got to merge those two, but I think the VHS era, I mean, this documentary is called VHS Massacre, The Decline of Cult Films and the Decline of Physical Media, or just VHS Massacre if you like, but it really is about, home movies. So it goes through, you know, basically the first time someone could watch a movie at home is 16mm print, and you had to be pretty rich to do that even still.
Right.
And then from there you had Super 8, and then they actually offered these 8-minute digest of films. So you could watch 8 minutes of Frankenstein at home on Super 8.
I remember my dad doing that. He'd show us, he'd break out the projector and show us, I think it was a Beast from 20,000 Fans that we'd watch.
Yep.
8 minutes of.
We had a few of those too.
It always made me want to see more of this for sure.
Yeah, I actually want to maybe start collecting them or something.
Reasonably priced, usually on eBay. They don't go for a lot of money because there's a lot of them out there. So.
Yeah, but in this doc, I learned a lot about all that stuff. Like one of the guys we interview is Carmen Capobianco, and he told me basically, you know, 8mm film was essentially 16mm film in your camera, and you'd shoot 50 feet, and then you'd flip the roll over and shoot another 50 feet, and what you were doing is shooting both sides of a 16mm film. So when it got processed, they would split it down the middle, and essentially that's what 8mm was. It was just 16mm chopped in half, which I never
knew.
Know
that,
And then they came out with Super 8, and that was its own, you know, format. But and then it goes through the VHS era and into streaming and all that good stuff. But it's not a bummer. It's not like, let's weep for the decline of physical media. But it definitely is. It definitely looks at the video store era as like sort of a wonderful time for independence, because mainly because of title discovery, and when you walked into a video store, essentially it was like a gallery, you know, and in the digital space, title discovery, as my brother Bruce Seymour says, very difficult, you know.
Well, to me, there was two gold rushes that I semi-experienced as a distributor. The first one, though, I say semi, I came in too far in on the tail end of the VHS releases, because video stores were just so hungry for product that they were picking everything up, putting it on their shelves, paying $80 a tape or more sometimes, and then, of course, DVD. I didn't see the gold rush with Blu-ray. I think it was too hard for too many companies to get into, and they were reluctant. You don't really see it with VOD, but yeah, I mean, those were two errors of distribution, like, you know, I've never seen before, at least at my level. You know, that it was just amazing, you know, the stuff that would get out there and you could discover, and that, you know, some ways, I mean, YouTube, you know, a lot of stuff gets bootlegged on, but that was a way to discover these movies.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And you're in the doc, Ron, obviously. And one of my favorite lines that you said basically is you got into distribution as VHS was dying and somehow survived and, you know, thrived, especially probably when DVDs came in, you probably
Yeah, that was the best time when I first when DVDs first launched. You know, I didn't come out immediately. I think it took me a year or two before I could afford it. So,
and this whole trend is actually having consequences beyond just the film industry. I was reading something about a lot of states are looking at imposing streaming taxes for video because they are looking to impose these taxes.
No, I know, I believe it, but they were because they were doing the same thing with the online retailers. I'm not surprised.
Yeah, well, they're looking to do that because DVD sales have basically evaporated, and that was a pretty good source of sales tax revenue for a lot of these places. So this whole thing is evolving in a way that I don't even think we can predict where it's going to be in 5 years.
It's constantly changing, yeah.
No, and we actually have Joe Bob Briggs is actually in the documentary from Monster Vision. And
awesome.
And he's got a great rant at the end. He basically talked about don't fight it when it changes, and meaning he examines the technology of film, and it's like Bron just said, it does change every couple of years. It changes, and so Joe Bob Briggs basically don't fight it when it changes. And I think what he's saying is that ultimately we're gonna have to ride it out and see what happens.
It's going to change regardless of our resistance to it. It's just going to change.
And there's just so much product out there. It's hard to even for like the indie guys to get front and center with the and the streaming options and stuff like that. So
Well, also just as a cultural idea of no longer collecting things, like the people, some people may choose to not have libraries of books. Some people choose may not have libraries of films or video games, or and it's a huge significant cultural change, and people talk about it, but I'm not sure that they really think about the repercussions of like, let's say, if you have a book, specifically a movie, sometimes you're streaming a film, and let's say you hit that buy button. In some cases, you're not getting the download on your machine. You're basically getting access to the file streaming. So you hit that buy button, and yes, it always has been a license. But as far as property rights, it's very strange to not be able to watch something independent of being on the internet.
Right.
Something that you've paid for, independent of being on the internet. Yeah.
I think it's grew up with trying to move around like hundreds and thousands of VHS, of my personal collection, then DVDs. Stuff when the streaming comes along, it's nice to have that collection on my tablet or something and watch it. But I think there is also that younger generation coming up who's like, I want to physically hold some of this stuff. So there is still some demand for the physical. It's just kind of smaller circles, significant circles. I do well with limited edition, releases, VHS even too, but.
Oh, yeah. That you're in the end of the dock, and you're actually a huge help to the dock because you and there's probably four or five companies we mentioned towards the end of just sort of, hey, look at what these guys are doing. Like, VHS there are new movies being released on VHS, and that's very interesting, and who knew that? One person from the documentary is Nick Brewer, and he compared it to vinyl, and that's butted right up against, Lloyd Kaufman saying, well, vinyl has a significant quality difference and advantage, whereas VHS is just, far less resolution.
I think the appeal is just that artwork. It's bigger. It's especially the big boxes, which I do like. Just so much more. I mean, I know it's not much bigger than a DVD, but there's something just more impressive about it.
Mm-hmm.
And darker and dirtier, I guess, about it. People find appealing.
Oh, for horror films, it can be beneficial, I think.
Yeah, I like watching some of them on VHS over DVD, some of the older ones, when they're not crystal clear. In many ways, they were scarier.
Well, we were also discussing at one point, Ron, I don't remember who our guest was, but a lot of these films, or maybe it wasn't us, but anyway, a lot of these films, they were made, they weren't made for the resolutions that you can see today.
Yeah, it
might have
been Mark Bologna, I think.
And the makeup is flawed when you can see it in high def, and, it's just not the same experience.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
There's two different experiences there almost, yeah. Oh, go ahead, Tom.
I want to mention that Ken Powell is also the co-director of VHS Mascot. I just didn't want to leave him out. And he part of the fun is he and I went hunting around New York to some of the last surviving video stores. And the weird thing is that we shot the stock from 2012 to 2014, and almost every video store we went to went out of business within that time frame.
Oh, geez. I'm surprised that there's still VHS stores around. Every so often I'll hear about one that does like rentals or something. So
yeah, well, this one, Video Express, had a VHS section, and they went out of business the next year. We went to, somehow we find a surviving Blockbuster in 2012.
Oh, wow.
And that went out. And then, honestly, right when we were pretty much done. We were wrapped on the dock, and then Kim's Video in New York City in the East Village, a very famous New York video store, went out, and we had to go and cover that, and that was a bummer, I have to say.
Yeah, definitely. Kim's was like an icon of that area, and any filmmaker knew who Kim's Video was. So, well, we got to wrap things up, Tom, but can you give us a quick rundown on what you've got, like, you know, developing and where people can find you?
Oh, yeah. Well, if you look up New York Cine, that's New York and then CINE.com, mm-hmm. that has some info on the VHS Massacre. And if you look up my full name, ThomasEdwardSeymour.com, that'll give you what I'm working on. But to sum it up, the next thing we have going, well, we're hitting the festivals, entering festivals now with VHS Massacre, and then the new film's called Monster Kill, which is great. It's a creep show. It's three movies in one. It's got so Mermaidators from space. It's got Groom with Bigfoot, and it's got Flying Snake Attack.
Ooh.
So, yeah, that's pretty much it.
Excellent. I'm excited to see you go something big and epic again. So.
Awesome, awesome. Thanks, man. I really appreciate being asked to be on the show.
Yeah,
thanks.
We appreciate all the info.
Thanks for being on the program, Thomas. Great to chat with you. Hopefully we'll have you back on again soon.
And good luck with the
anytime. I'd love to be on again. All right, thanks.
All right, take care.
Bye. Take care, Tom.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Ron and I will wrap things up. We'll offer a recommendation of a classic. It's all here on Horror Talk on CNY Talk Radio and blogtalkradio.com. Welcome back to Horror Talk on the Horror Talk Network and blogtalkradio.com and CNY Talk Radio. We appreciate you joining us. If you've got a question or you'd like to recommend a film for us to chat about or a guest to bring on the program, send us an email. At this point, it's talk@horrortalknetwork.com. Questions, comments, movies, whatever. We'd love to hear from you. Right now, we're going to talk about classic films. We each take an opportunity to recommend a film that's at least 20 years old, something that you got to put on your queue to view. And I'll start out this time, Ron. One I'm really surprised we actually haven't mentioned yet, but I'm going to recommend The Shining.
Oh, okay.
Of course, 1980, Stanley Kubrick directed, Stephen King adaptation. And as we know with Stephen King movies, there's some good ones and there's a lot of bad ones.
Yeah, there was a whole period with his early ones. I remember them being kind of bashed in the press. And you go back and look at them. Majority of them were excellent movies.
Yeah.
You know, there wasn't too many misfires. It's more of the recent ones I haven't really been.
Yeah, I mean, Christine was good. Cujo was good. The Shining's
Carrie
great.
Was good.
Carrie's
Dead Zone
good.
Was great.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, like I said, The Shining was awesome. I know The Shining he wasn't a big fan of.
Yeah, Stephen King actually himself said, The Shining is all flash. It's a fancy car without an engine. Mm-hmm. But I think in retrospect, I don't know how he feels, but I think in retrospect, that film really holds up well. And it may not be, I think what Stephen King, obviously, he compares anything that's made from his work to his work. But I think if you look at The Shining as a standalone film, it's a great film. It's a great horror film.
Yeah, I felt like from what I gathered, he felt like he basically kind of changed the theme, the idea from the book, from what King intended.
Yeah.
And this is a problem with it. But it's an excellent horror movie. I mean, it's very creepy.
Oh, there's some great scenes. The twin girls at the end of the hallway.
Yeah, some of them are memorable.
Unbelievable how haunting that image is. And what makes that so haunting? It's two girls standing within a hallway.
There's something about Kubrick, the way he shoots.
Wow.
I don't know if it's the framing, if it's the set design. It's just there's so many of his movies have this imagery that just sticks with you.
Yeah, and that in particular, I think that is one of the most iconic images in horror, at least modern horror.
Yeah, I've seen people, photographers, duplicate it. I saw recently that I think they did the picture with the two girls growing up.
Yeah, you know, yeah. So well, those two girls, I can't remember their names, but they're out of England and they're doing the horror convention circuit too. So,
oh, nice.
Based on that, you know, the few seconds and those exactly. images flash up there pretty quickly. They're not on there long, and they've got a career out of that now. You know, obviously Jack Nicholson. Did you ever see the documentary Room 237 about? The
I have. I've heard it so much bash. There was something else I watched that that covered The Shining though. That was pretty interesting. I wish I could remember the name of it.
They talk about all
no, I didn't
hidden,
see that with the...
That particular documentary, and I'm not so sure I buy it, but that documentary says that The Shining was Kubrick's way of sending messages that the moon landing was fake
yeah.
and that he was the director that filmed the
That's always been the rumor, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And The Shining was his way of telling everybody.
It does, the moon landing does look like his work, so...
What do you got?
There's a Steadicam shot in there, too, isn't there? No, yeah. In the moon landing. Yeah. I'm going this week, and I mentioned it last week, but I didn't actually mention it as my pick of the week. But I'm going to go with House, which is written by Fred Decker, you know, I picked a Monster Squad last week and also did, if I remember right, one of my picks was Night of the Creeps as well. I'm a big Fred Decker fan, even more so than I realized until I started looking up who did these movies. Directed by Steve Miner, stars William Catt. It's about this author. He goes into this house that he inherits, and along the way he loses his kid. But it's just so atmospheric, and it's awesome. And it's a great mixture of being really scary at points and very comedic. It has George Wenham from Cheers. It was really weird to see him in. I remember when I saw him.
Is that pre-Cheers? What year was the film?
No, it was during Cheers, I think, 86.
Oh, okay.
If anything, Cheers is just about to end or may have just ended. But when I saw him, I was like, oh, they're going to have Norm
right,
in this
right,
movie?
Right,
it's going
right.
to ruin it. And he was, like, great in the movie. Even the dude from Night Court, Richard Mole, was in it as sort of the villain.
I think Cheers was, like, mid-80s into the 90s.
Okay, so it was still out.
Because I know George Wendt was in Fletch with Chevy Chase, and I think that was 84, and that was pre-Cheers.
Okay. It might have been right around the time.
Right,
time. Geez, I was graduating from high school, I think. Cheers had been running for a while. At that point, but anyways, I just remember knowing he was from Cheers when I saw the movie, and maybe I didn't see it right when it came out, and just being impressed with it. I mean, I should have known from the original poster; it's just great. But kind of reminds me of it's got like that Creepshow vibe. It's got that's even though Decker didn't direct it, it's definitely got his sort of vibe, you know, going through it.
Yeah.
And I think in many ways just an overlooked, you know, excellent horror. It seems to be discovered more nowadays, but at the time I felt like it was very much
overlooked. Now, you just mentioned, just to get off track a little bit, you mentioned Night of the Creeps, and I don't think we've mentioned since our last program that Jason Lively...
I was going to ask you to plug, or I was going to mention you plugging that when you talk about ScareCon.
From Night of the Creeps is going to be joining us at ScareCon, a very late addition to the celebrity guest.
You get new additions every week, and that's a... That's definitely a fun one.
Yeah, that's going to be pretty cool.
I mean, he's probably better known for European Vacation, but I would have obviously known.
Well, not to the ScareCon group.
Not to the ScareCon group, too.
Yeah. True. So speaking of that, what do you got going on with your company these days? You got stuff that people might want to check out?
I've got another Mark Polonia release. It's Polonia Brothers release. Mark was a guest on the show several weeks back and stuff. He put together all his old Super 8mm shorts they made with his brother before they got into video and shot a new wraparound in an anthology called Death Reel. We're going to be releasing that tomorrow night because I'm going away for like 11 days after that. So I wanted to get that out before I left. And potentially another double feature from him, which will be Bad Magic and Church of the Damned, which is, again, two other early works from Mark. So I got that going on. She Kills is playing a film festival. It's first one in Ottawa. The weekend of ScareCon, I would have went up to it, but unfortunately it tied in.
Always the case.
I didn't realize it. I'd been offered to submit it there. I didn't realize what weekend was on, and we were all set to cruise up to it. And then it was, ScareCon weekend. So maybe we'll leave ScareCon part way. Probably not. ScareCon's too much fun. And just shot a week for a new movie that I'm working on called House Shark. Basically, a Jaws in a house. I wanted to do a Spielberg Jaws homage. I've always wanted to do a Jaws movie. So. We got two more blocks of shooting. It's going to be stretched out over pretty much the next year, but that was the best way to do it with the actors. And still editing Empire State of the Dead. So I got three big productions just kind of kicking around right now.
Cool. You're always busy, that's for sure. I need you to swing the mic over there for a second.
Sure.
Got to ask, we got James in the studio here too from Ghost Goons. What do you have coming up on your program?
We are reviewing the Woman in Black 2. This Thursday.
Okay.
We're going to do that one. That's a pretty new release.
Now, the Ghost Goons, James's program, is also available on blogtalkradio.com, and it's under the same Horror Talk Network that our program is, so you can check it out there. Some of the films you've done in the past?
A lot of more modern stuff. Woman in Black 1, obviously. Grave Encounters. The Room, which you mentioned. Just stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah, and you guys like to have a little bit of fun with it.
Yeah.
And you do your show live. You guys have the technology to do it live so you can take phone calls.
Yep.
Yeah, we're still working on that over here.
Yep. Thursdays.
We are behind.
Thursdays 8 to 9. No. Right. No. No, 10 to 11.
10 to 11.
10 to 11.
8 to 9, you're thinking about it.
Yeah, 8 to 9, we're preparing for it. There you go.
All right, well, check that out. That's the Ghost Goons, also found on blogtalkradio.com, the Horror Talk Network, right next to our program. But we thank you for joining us, and we welcome you to join us every week. Send us an email, talk@horrortalknetwork.com. Don't forget about Scarecon coming up. Check out the full details for that at scarecon.com. And I think it's going to do it.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah. Thanks for listening. I'm JV for Ron Bonk. We'll see you next week.
Oh, srscinema.com. Thank you.